So we're coming to the end of our discussion of the First Great Awakening. We've noticed a lot of things. We started with a bit of an understanding of the religious climate in America, in the colonies. We talked about the church covenants that were such a big part of the early experience of religion in our country. Then we talked about the second generation problem, people who had been baptized as babies, but they'd never presented their conversion narrative. That meant that they weren't part of the church. And so then when they had children, their children couldn't be baptized. And that created a lot of tension within families, within churches, you know, a lot of things go on, because not only were you not a part of the church, you didn't have a lot of civil rights as well. And the response to that was the halfway covenant that Samuel Stoddard kind of came up with. He didn't come up with it, but he was one of the advocates for the halfway covenant, which said, okay, you're not really a part of the church, but we're going to treat you like a part of the church, and you can present your children to be baptized. And so in that context, then Jonathan Edwards has to respond to that development. And Jonathan Edwards really pleaded to go back to where they had been, but he didn't go all the way back to a Calvinist position. And so we're going to talk a little bit tonight, and I think probably next week, about the impact that Edwards had on the religious climate. And it wasn't just Edwards, it was a lot of people, but Edwards was kind of the leading spokesman. And what you find developing as a result of all of this is a really fractured kind of religious climate in America. We think of it as Augustinian or Calvinist on one side, and Pelagian, or what's been described as Arminianism, on the other side, as if those were just two poles. And the defining characteristic of the differences between them has been expressed with the acronym TULIP: total inability, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. And these two camps that we talk about were a part of the religious community in the early New England colonies. They talk about it in their writings in a little bit different language than what we generally use. They talked about a monergistic approach, which means that God is the only actor in man's salvation, and then a synergistic approach, which would mean that God and man cooperate in man's salvation. So they talk about natural ability or natural inability, and we sometimes call that total hereditary depravity, but that doesn't really quite capture it. I like this chart better: natural ability or natural inability, The Calvinists would argue man is naturally unable to understand and believe the gospel unless God puts faith into the man. The synergistic approach, the Arminian approach, would be that man is naturally able to understand and believe the gospel apart from some divine involvement. Now, we're going to go on and we're going to notice as we look more closely at the religious communities that these two poles don't really represent the situation. We're going to take a nuanced approach that understands that there are, that this is really a continuum. And these are the two ends of the spectrum. Calvinists talk about sovereign election, and the synergistic folks, the Arminians, talk about prescient election. Sovereign election, the condition for salvation is the sovereign electing will of God and God alone. The synergistic approach, the condition for salvation is faith, which man exercises of his own ability. God chooses those who choose him. So man is involved in coming to God. And when man comes to God, God chooses him. Redemption, of course, the Calvinists would argue particular redemption. Christ didn't die for the salvation of everyone. Christ did, in fact, secure the salvation of his church individually and collectively. So Christ died really for only the elect and also for the church. In terms of universal redemption, which is the Arminian position, the other end of the spectrum, Christ's redeeming work made it possible for everyone to be saved, but he didn't actually secure the salvation of anyone until someone came to him in faith. Now, the universalist position is Christ died for everyone, and so everyone is saved. That wasn't a big part of the religious climate in the early colonies. Then the effectual calling of God. The Calvinists say God calls to the elect, and the calling of God to the elect does affect salvation infallibly. In other words, you can't resist it. Human resistance, that would be the Arminian position, the other end of the spectrum, man is free and can successfully resist the Spirit's call. Then as far as eternal security, the Calvinists argue that once you're saved, you are saved. It cannot be reversed. Saving faith is eternal. The Arminian position would be that because faith is a necessary condition for salvation, it can be lost if a man rejects his faith. And man can reject his faith. So those are the two ends of the spectrum. They're as far apart as they could be. Calvinists, and that's what we've been talking about. That's the Congregationalists, the Puritans. They would argue for the Calvinist position. On the other side, You had the Arminians. This is the few Southern Baptists that are out there, but they're not really a very strong force. The Presbyterians would have been on the Calvinist side. And of course, then Catholics occupy a separate place, but there weren't very many Catholics in the early colonies. So does that make sense to everyone? Is that clear? That when we talk about this, we're talking about the absolute ends of the spectrum. And what we're going to see in a minute is that most of the folks in the early colonies weren't way out at the ends of the spectrum. They were somewhere in the middle.
You answered my question. My question was, where are people landing on this?
Well, somebody like Jonathan Edwards, he's not as far out on the Calvinist side as a lot of folks were. He's more of a moderate Calvinist. He entertains most of the notions of Calvinism, but not all of the notions of Calvinism.
Interesting.
And then you have the Lutherans. Now, there weren't many Lutherans in America, but the Lutherans occupied a place that was different than where even Jonathan Edwards was. And the Arminians, the separate Baptists, they're sometimes called, or the Southern Baptists, they tended to classical Arminianism. They tended to move over to the other side of the spectrum. So if you started out with hyper-Calvinism and you're Jonathan Edwards responding to the halfway covenant by saying, look, we need to get back to where we were, you have to understand that Jonathan Edwards didn't go all the way back to Calvin. People took two steps forward, and Edwards said, wait a minute, we can't do that. We got to stay where we were. But he only took one step back. So the movement that grew up around Edwards and the Second Great Awakening was, in essence, one step away from really hyper-Calvinism. It didn't go as far as Wesley did and the Methodists, and we'll talk about them as we start talking about the Second Great Awakening. Certainly didn't go as far as the Baptist groups went, but this moderate Calvinism, Presbyterianism, this was a movement in the direction of what I think was a restoration of biblical information. It was not moving all the way, but it was a significant movement. So I'll give you this chart. You can look at this and spend some time looking at Luther and Wesley and some of the people that were involved in Methodism. It's just really interesting that the situation as it evolves in the colonies sort of focused on these four groups, and it's fractured now. And one of the things that's going to lead to the Second Great Awakening is dissatisfaction that it's so fractured. Questions? Okay. A lot of this, the difference between these folks, gets down to something called a notion that's called the order of decrees. And this is kind of, at what point did God decide what? Okay. So you have two kind of ends of the spectrum. Again, you have supra-lapsarianism, and sometimes that's called by these other names, anti-lapsarianism, pre-lapsarianism, or sometimes it's spelled pre-lapsarian. And then you have infra-lapsarianism, and that divides itself into two groups of sub-lapsarianism, and sometimes this whole group is called post-lapsarian. So, here's the question. At what point did God decide to save some and condemn others? And he did make that decision. Some people are going to be saved and some people are going to be lost. At what point did he make that decision? Was it supralapsarian? Was it before he ever even created people? Or was it infralapsarian after people had sinned? And I can't stress enough how important this was to their thought process. It's not something that we talk about very often. We typically say that God, before the beginning of the world, determined that he was going to send Jesus, but we don't try to pin that down exactly when that happened. So if you take the supralapsarian position that God decided to save some and condemn others before he ever even created man, then what that means is God decided to create some people who were going to be lost. He created some people who are going to be saved. So that makes God the author of sin. Okay. Now, what happened at the fall? What happened when man sinned? Well, is that the point at which he decided to elect those who would listen to him and to cause those that wouldn't listen to him to be lost? Now, that's typically the point at which I have argued that God decided who was going to be saved and who was going to be lost. But it was based on his knowledge of what we were going to do. Now, it doesn't bother me that God had to create a plan before this happened to say that God foreknew that some people would be saved and some people would be lost, so that God could create the plan even before he had to put it into effect. Some people would argue, no, God can't create the plan. If he knows, then you don't have free will. So I think that God determined to save those who would listen to him and to condemn those who would not. Now, if you don't take that position, then you the best you can do is infralapsarianism. Some men are saved from condemnation and others are condemned, but that wasn't a decision that God made until people sinned. See, in infralapsarianism, you make that decision before people have ever sinned. When Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden and they walk and they talk with God and they tend and keep the garden, they eat all of the fruit of all of the trees that are in the garden. They spent some time in that idyllic place and under those idyllic conditions. And then they sinned and everything changed. And if you take the position that God decided that he was going to condemn some people to death before they sinned, then even before they were created, God created some people that were going to be condemned.
But doesn't that take away our free will? It's not just because he knows that we are not going to make it. He makes every effort to give us chances in order to follow his will. It's not he's condemning them. It's that we condemn ourselves.
Well, the real Calvinists, the hardline Calvinists would argue, no, God doesn't give you chances. It wouldn't make any sense if God gave you chances because you couldn't respond anyway. You don't have the ability to respond.
If all that's true, why did Christ have to come to the earth and give his life to save people who weren't going to be saved anyway?
Okay, well, I agree with you, Jimmy. That I agree with that point, and that's the argument that I would make about all of this. But I'm just saying this is the environment that Edwards is working with, and this is.
If you said that, you would say at the creation, because I think the plan is already in order. It probably before even Adam and Eve sinned, he knew that men would, if you had free choice, it's more fun. Sin is a lot more fun than having to be obedient. And so I'm saying that because it really is, but I hear what you're saying. That's what they did, and then that's not, it's not quite the end.
You're right, Jimmy, that this notion that God is the only one that works, monergistic approaches, man does not have free will in that approach. Now, that's the situation that Edwards has to wrestle with all of this in. This is his background. So I say all of that to just point out that he didn't have some of the advantages that we have. This is what the chart says in visual form. this slide says in word form. So, what was Edward's contribution to restoration? How did Jonathan Edwards and the New England theologists, how did they move away from old Calvinist doctrine? It really focuses on about five areas, but two of them are really critically important. One is, what do you make of original sin? Now, here's the Calvinist view. Adam is the federal head of all humanity. When Adam sinned, God imputed his sin to all human beings, whether they had been born or not. If you're a human being, God imputed Adam's sin to you. That gives you a corrupt nature. And then you're going to commit your own sins, and you will also incur your own guilt, but you have guilt that's associated with Adam's sin. So, in terms of the Calvinist approach to original sin, sin is imputed prior to the time of your actual transgression. Okay. So Edwards changed that a little bit. He didn't reject the idea of original sin completely, but he moved away from the Calvinist viewpoint. And what he said was, as soon as a man's, or a person's, not man, a person's moral acts concur with Adam's sin, they become guilty of Adam's sin. There, our first sin is an extension of what Adam did. There's no any kind of alien guilt to me, because I don't come under condemnation until I sin. But when I sin, that's when I get everything that was due to Adam. And he said it this way. Let me move out of the way here. The apostasy is not theirs merely because God imputes it to them, but it is truly and properly theirs because they sin. And on that ground, God imputes it to them. So he didn't get away from original sin completely. But he did move to the point where it's imputed because you chose to sin. So sin is not... sin is not inherent. Sin is endemic. You don't have to sin, but everybody does. Can you see the subtle difference between those two positions? It's an important difference. It's subtle. It's not, he didn't go all the way away from original sin. He wouldn't go as far as, the position that Ezekiel espoused, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. You don't die because of your parents' sin. You die because of your own sin. So he wouldn't go that far. But once you sin, you're guilty of original sin. And that impacts freedom of will. The Calvinist's point of view is that because you're born and God imputed sin to you, that means that your nature is so corrupt at the time of birth that you are unable to love or submit to God. You are incapable of it. And here, again, Edwards moves away from that, not all the way, not rejecting it completely and not saying man has free will completely, but he moves away from it. So this is what Edwards would have said. Human freedom is consistent with human depravity. Free will is consistent with original sin or inability. Now, he says the will is as the greatest apparent good is. Let's see if we can unpack that a little bit. By that he means once the mind discerns what action results in the greatest benefit to self, then the will is activated and you make a choice. The will is free. Freedom is the power of the individual to do as he or she pleases. What pleases a person is determined, in his view, by their character or the orientation of their soul. Edwards called that the soul's disposition. And now here's where he brings along a little bit of Calvinism. Individuals cannot change the disposition of their soul, nor would they want to, because sinful human beings by nature have no disposition to submit to God. They will never see Christ as their greatest good, and they will consistently never choose to follow him. Edwards makes a distinction between natural ability, and you always have the ability to choose, but you have the moral inability to choose. Jesus will never appear to be the best and highest good for you. And because Jesus will never appear to be the best and highest good, you would never choose Jesus. You could. Calvinists would argue, you can't even choose. Edward says, no, you can choose. It's just that you won't choose. Only God, in Edward's view, can grant a person's soul a new disposition, which is capable of seeing God as the greatest good. Once God gives me the disposition, then I can see God as the greatest good, and I can exercise my free will to choose to follow him. So those are the two biggest areas of departure for Jonathan Edwards. One is the concept of his concept of original sin. And the second is his concept of the freedom of the will. He didn't reject completely Calvinist thought, but he does move a step away from it. So that's why he's so important, at least in my mind, to subsequent developments in the Restoration period, which is the second great awakening. Now, Edwards made three other points that I think are worthy of noting. They kind of come out of the first two. They're not the place where people generally go to immediately think about Jonathan Edwards. Edwards talked about disinterested love. I find this really interesting. True Christians, remember, the converted, the ones that are elect, true Christians are disinterested in themselves, and they're completely preoccupied with the beauty of God and His ways. And that's only possible through conversion. So that's why he still wanted to have that conversion narrative. You still had to present it. Babies were still baptized. Baptism had very little to do with salvation in his mind. It was the conversion narrative that was so important. True Christians are disinterested in themselves and completely preoccupied with the beauty of God and His ways. That's only possible when you're converted, when you're really converted. And then he talked about how you know that you're converted, how you the assurance that you have that you are saved. Anything that you can think of that's driven by self-interest is not a mark of true religion. So a person who had been converted would never say, God loves me. He would say God loves, but he would never say God loves me. That's this disinterested love. True Christians do nothing out of self-benefit. They would never say, I am saved. That's self-benefit. If you ever made that statement, I'm saved, then you're not, because you haven't become interested in God to the exclusion of interest in self. And that's why he could argue what he did about returning to the covenant. The idea of the covenant. And then the third thing that he said that kind of comes from those first two is it deals with sanctification. Disinterested love leads to an ethic of self-denial because you're not interested in yourself. And the self is replaced with the desire to see others saved.
Dean?
Yeah.
But how can he say that if only God saves people?
I mean,
right, but
isn't that a flaw in their logic?
No, it's not. And here's why. God is the only one that can do the saving. And when you are saved, you are so impressed with God that you don't even think about yourself. Self is not even in the equation. You're not the actor that obtained salvation. It's given to you. And once it's given to you, you never think about it as yours. That's a thought process that's a little foreign to us. But you have to begin with the fact that this is a monergistic approach. God is the only operator.
Well, Dean, I understand that part of it. In fact, that sort of makes me think of Lenny's lesson last night, that you're supposed to give God the glory, the honor, and the power. So this is sort of like giving God all of the power. That I understand. It's the sanctification where now the self is replaced by the desire to save others. If only God can save others, and he turns it on, how do you have the desire to save others?
Well, remember, your job, that's the wrong way to say it, your part in this is to present them with the idea that God is the greatest good. And once God gives them a new disposition that lets them see that, then that's your only goal. God is still the only the only operator here. But remember his position on free will. You have the ability to see it if it's presented to you. You just don't have the moral ability to choose it until God changes your disposition. And then you will choose it. I have a hard time arguing the Calvinist position, because I keep running into the same problem that you're running into, Carol. I keep running into, so I'm just trying to present the Calvinist position. It's not a position that I subscribe to. And so it's hard for me to present it fairly. But I really do want to try to present it without being pejorative about it. And I'm, as you may guess, I'm having a hard time with it. I have to choose my words very carefully. So I hope that this makes sense. My point in discussing the first awakening is to say that they made some baby steps away from Calvinism, away from Congregationalism, away from the sort of the Church of England. Calvin Jonathan Edwards never tried to throw off the Church of England. He wanted to reform it from within. But what he said laid the groundwork for people to continue thinking about this stuff. And that's what led to the second Great Awakening. Now, part of the second Great Awakening, remember, is looking at the situation that happened as a result of what Edwards said, and you had a fractured religious climate. And that fractured religious climate is what prompted people in the second awakening to say, wait a minute, it shouldn't be this way. Everybody should be able to be together. If we're all wanting to serve God, we should all be together. We shouldn't have this chaotic situation that presented itself. And I have another chart that makes the chaos seem even worse, but the chart is a little bit hard to see, and it just breaks down more of these categories of thought. And it kind of reinforces the idea that, man, we're all over the map with this stuff. We ought to be able to get together. And so you had people who said, look, we could get together if we just said, we'll say what the Bible says and no more. There's no sense arguing about lapse in Arianism because the Bible doesn't quite say when those decisions were made. So you guys are fussing about things that the Bible just really doesn't answer. It's kind of like it's beyond your pay grade. Stop worrying about it. So that's what happened. And then the second thing that was a part of the second Great Awakening was, how are we going to organize churches? What is this visible, invisible church distinction? How do we know what churches are supposed to look like? So next week, we'll kind of talk about the different groups that came out of all of this and what the situation was like prior to the beginning of the second Great Awakening. A lot of people came back to God during this first awakening. A lot of people were returning to a life of faith. Now, maybe it was a life of faith that wasn't perfect, and undoubtedly that's the case, but they were exhibiting an interest in God, and they hadn't exhibited that interest before. So it's kind of like what I think Carol was saying. If I can't do anything about it, why worry about it? And Edward said, no, you can do something about it. So we'll talk about some of the groups that kind of came out of all of this. Other thoughts. I could give you a bunch of stuff to read. It's frankly, it's hard to read. You have to read it. You have to put aside what you know and try to understand it from where they started. So it's really hard. Well, thank you guys for hanging in there with me. I know we get I get a little bit far afield, but I think it's important to understand how all of this was going to play out in the Second Awakening, and what we typically refer to as the Restoration Movement. Now, the really incredible thing about the Restoration Movement is it was a movement that we are most familiar with from an American perspective, but this Restoration Movement was happening all over the world, and people were kind of learning, hey, you guys are thinking the same way I'm thinking. And why aren't we together? So you had the Scotch, who had a major impact on what was going on in this country. There was a minor influence from the Netherlands. I think that kind of reinforces for me that God has always had people that wanted to serve him. And we sometimes think, no, it started in the Restoration Movement. It didn't start there. It kind of bubbled to the surface there. But there had always been people that wanted to serve God who had rejected notions of Calvinism. You go all the way back to Pelagius. There have always been people that argued for free will. The Calvinists were in the ascendancy, or the Lutherans prior to the Calvinists. But there have always been people that wanted to serve God.